Hello and welcome to this Innovation Forum webinar with me, Ian Welsh. Today we're going to be debating what makes companies act on business and human rights. In the past, companies have viewed human rights risks as principally reputational. If abuses are found, the impact on the company's reputation has been at the forefront, making them act. But is this still the case? There is, of course, now legislation designed to keep companies in check, such as the UK Modern Slavery Act. However, how far do these rules and regulations really go? Are they driving change in corporate behaviour? And what are the other motivators for business to protect human rights? And how far do corporate human rights policies go in safeguarding the rights of those in their operations and supply chains? What is the role of other stakeholders in encouraging and helping business to make proactive action on human rights? And ultimately, what does make companies act? We have two experts in business and human rights with us today to help frame our discussion. Firstly, we have Maurizio Lazzella, Deputy Director, Business and Human Rights Resource Centre. Maurizio has very kindly stepped in at the last minute as a replacement for Phil Bloomer, who has unfortunately lost his voice. So all the best to Phil for a speedy recovery, and many thanks to Maurizio for joining us at short notice. Secondly, we have Caroline Meledo, Senior Manager at Corporate Responsibility for Hilton Worldwide, and soon to become the Global Lead for Corporate Responsibility and Human Rights. And my thanks to my Innovation Forum colleague, Ailey Morrison, for convening our panel and organising this webinar. The issues we'll be covering today will be discussed further at Innovation Forum's upcoming Conference on Business and Human Rights in London on the 1st and 2nd of November. Full details of this interactive and engaging event are on Innovation Forum's website, where you can sign up now for best priced passes. And I hope to see you there. Back to today. I will shortly invite our panellists to make some opening remarks to kick things off. We will have some follow-up discussion, and I will then open the debate up to the audience questions, particularly during the second half of the webinar. We do want to be as interactive as possible today, so please do submit your questions using the comments box on the webinar dashboard, and I will put them to our panel. Questions can be directed to all the panel or to one panelist in particular, and if you can keep your questions short, it is more likely that I will use them. Please also note that, as usual for Innovation Forum webinars, there will be no slides or presentations. This is a structured panel discussion throughout. So, turning to our panel, Maurizio, perhaps you can go first and outline from your perspective the trends that you're seeing and what motivates companies to act on human rights risks in their operations and supply chains. How are these changing, and in particular, to what extent are companies recognising that we're talking about more than just reputational risk? Maurizio.
Hello, everybody, and thank you, Ian, for that introduction. Thanks for inviting us to speak at this panel. Well, the title of this webinar is slightly provocative, and the first thing really to say is something very, very obvious that I think everybody will agree with, but nevertheless, I think it's very important to repeat it because sometimes it gets forgotten in the many events and panels and different discussions that we all attend. And that is that human rights, companies should care about human rights just simply because it's the right thing to do. It's the moral and right thing to do. And a company that claims to care about the lives of human beings can simply not disregard human rights. So that is the main reason that drives changes and that should be underlying everything that companies do. And I think it's pretty obvious to everyone listening to this webinar, but I nevertheless wanted to put it out there. Now, really, regarding reputation risks, that certainly has played a major part in the past in driving change for in the field of business and human rights. I've been working in this field for the last almost 12 years, and I've seen that reputation risk is a major driver of change. Increasingly nowadays, the other side of the coin is also playing a key role, and the other side of the coin is reputation reward for companies that do that do the right thing in terms of human rights. So I will give you a few examples and I will end with a few reflections. The first example I wanted to talk about is an initiative that was launched earlier this year in which we are participating, and that's called the Corporate Human Rights Benchmark. Apologies if you all already know the Corporate Human Rights Benchmark, but for those who are not familiar with that, I will give just a very, very, very brief introduction to the benchmark. Basically, the Corporate Human Rights Benchmark aims to assess 98 of the largest publicly traded companies in the world on 100 human rights indicators. That wasn't a simple thing to do. It took over 3 years of consultations and methodology development until we reached the stage in which we could go public with this ranking. Earlier this year, 98 companies in three different sectors were assessed and were ranked. The main conclusions, the main results of the initial benchmark were that there is a small leading pack of companies that are definitely pulling ahead of the rest. So these are six companies that scored 50% or more in the benchmark. But then the majority of the companies is still below the 50% mark with differences. But definitely the key message is that there is still a long way to go for most of the companies that were assessed in the Corporate Human Rights Benchmark. Now, I should add that this was an initiative that brought together investors, NGOs, and then rating agencies. So this is not just an NGO exercise, but unlike other benchmarks in similar fields, in social fields, this benchmark is also rating performance and not just policy. So we are doing policy and performance. And as I said, there is a small leading pack, but there is still a majority of companies with a long way to go. Now, in terms of the reputation reward, the intention of the benchmark is to drive a race to the top, but also drive a race from the bottom. By making this information very accessible with numbers, a lot of investors, and not just socially responsible investors, but also mainstream investors, can use the benchmark to reach the decisions in which companies they are investing. Now, the second point to make is that media and civil society are becoming more sophisticated in how change happens. So now they are also rewarding companies that do the right thing, and for an example on that, you need to just look at what's going on in the U.S. With the leadership that companies have taken in opposing some of the policies of the Trump administration that are seen to be in contradiction with international human rights norms, such as the travel ban and others, and climate change issues. So investors realize that the leaders have fewer risks, and they are rewarding these companies that take public positions on issues that perhaps 5 or 10 years ago, nobody would have expected those companies to speak publicly about. And the other reason why these companies are doing that is because they are trying to attract the best talent, and the millennial talent definitely wants to work for companies with values that reflect their own values. And this is especially in the IT sector, we've seen that people have the luxury still to choose the companies that they want to work in, and a lot of these people, this new generation, are choosing companies that align with their own values when doing so. So the loss of public trust in global markets to deliver shared prosperity is concentrating governments and some corporate minds on the need to be seen to humanize the markets. So while in the past the reputational risks of bad media, protests, boycotts, lawsuits, and non-judicial mechanisms such as the national contact point of the OECD and other UN mechanisms were the main drivers of change for companies, and they still are to some degree. I mean, those things are not going away, and there are scandals that lead to some of these things getting activated again, and you know, there are lawsuits going on against companies over human rights issues every week, every month in some place of the world. We track all of those on our website. But while these things are still going on, we believe that reputational rewards are going to take center stage in the future. But that includes also this issue of the mandatory transparency that many governments are now choosing to follow. So we have the Modern Slavery Act in the UK. We have the Australian government also considering modern slavery legislation. We have the due diligence law in France. And we have other transparency initiative going on at the EU level and in the US. So I will conclude there by saying that this increased emphasis on mandatory transparency and mandatory due diligence that includes also public procurement initiatives will encourage those companies that are still having got on to the train of human rights to do so. And so I will just finalize by saying, you know, all the companies that want more information on that, the information is available out there. There are many NGOs and other consultancies that provide that information, so it is no longer an excuse to say, I didn't know or I couldn't find that information. Everything is out there. I can say many more things, but I will be very happy to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thanks, Mauricio. Just a question from me, just around the legislation. You talked about the mandatory transparency that's coming in from governments in many parts of the world. What, in your view, makes for effective legislation in this area? Is it something that is the, you know, slightly soft legislation that we've seen from the UK Modern Slavery Act, for example, where it's really all about, as you say, transparency and just being seen to talk about what you are doing? Or is it legislation that has perhaps more teeth? What do you think works best?
Well, obviously, if you would ask the NGOs, they would all say the legislation that have teeth are the ones that are will be ultimately be more effective. But, you know, we think that the Modern Slavery Act in the UK is a good first step. It's certainly very voluntary, and the requirements are the lowest common denominator. But it's definitely a first step that is provoking a lot of thought inside companies and provoking dialogue around these issues of modern slavery. We just saw last week that there is an estimate of over 40 million people in modern slavery in supply chains around the world at the moment. So this is a major problem that is not going to go away very easily. We conduct a modern slavery report registration on our website. We have recorded already over 1,500 of such reports, and we certainly see that the quality is very variable. So there are those that just comply with the bare minimum, but there are those that go well beyond that. So we're going to be conducting an analysis of that with the intention that those reports that are the better ones become kind of role models for the other companies to follow.
Great. Well, thanks very much indeed. Okay. Caroline, turning to you, can you provide some context as to how the drivers for Hilton have changed and how these are impacting on the company's activities? And in particular, what's the extent that dealing with human rights is regarded now as a critical business issue? Caroline.
Thank you very much, Ian, and thank you very much for having me. I thought that I would share with you a little bit of the journey of Hilton in telling you about a few key drivers that have taken really a front seat in advancing the company's strategy and approach to human rights. To start with, I would like to just echo what Mauricio just said, which is that indeed we need to have the realization that respecting human rights does not need to have a business case. This is a fundamental that underlies the real conditions of being a human society and with enterprises as being corporate citizens as part of the society. It's very much the case for Hilton to see this as being at the core of what we do. We are hospitality. We are the leading hospitality company in the world, and we take pride in the care we provide to our team members, to our guests, to our business partners, and everybody else who contributes to the success of the company. So this is very much at the heart of what we are doing. At the start of our journey, in the industry, we started thinking about human rights very much by tackling some of the worst crimes and harms that could be done and that could sometimes happen and be linked to the hospitality industry, which is the child trafficking for sexual exploitation. We signed in 2011 the ECPAT Code of Conduct to fight against child exploitation, and we joined also the UN Global Compact. This was one of the first steps. We focused on training team members to identify the risks. In that case, with that first step, we were really looking at a couple of drivers, which were the health and safety, first and foremost, of our guests, team members, and other community members, which is paramount. So that's what really was driving that that first approach. On that same year, in 2011, the UN Guiding Principles were released. These became a framework of reference to help identify human rights impacts. And we use that framework of reference to understand the risks of modern slavery and the impact we may have as an enterprise on human rights. We want to know, and we want to know first, what might be happening in operations and supply chain. So we conducted back in 2015 our first human rights impact assessment at a global level, drafted a strategy, launched our human rights policy, and all of this was very much focused on the most salient human rights issues in our operations and supply chain. The key driver here was risk management and the need to know what is happening so that we can put in place a plan to manage and mitigate those risks. In 2015-16, the UK Modern Slavery Act obviously accelerated the approach to human rights. From our part, it only validated the strategy that we had already put in place. It really helped elevate the strategy at a much higher level on the agenda and helped the implementation be driven at a faster pace. The driver here was compliance, of course. It was a good leverage to have the right discussions at the right level to make sure that we identified the risks of modern slavery in operations and supply chain, which we had done through our impact assessment, and we could accelerate our implementation plan. Through the UK Modern Slavery Act, we also saw an increase of clients, corporate clients, that started asking more questions around modern slavery in their supply chain that we are part of. Here, the driver would be more commercial, helping us to again validate our strategy and continue implementing it diligently. With the rise of the approach to human rights in line with the UN Guiding Principles, we also saw an increasing and pressing need for collaboration. This is where we get together as an industry through the International Tourism Partnership across all of the larger brands in the hotel industry to share best practices and to share tools and solutions, because in these worlds, risks that exist are bigger than any of our companies individually. And we need to collaborate to find solutions to better identify and mitigate those risks. So we are a very proactive member of the Human Rights Working Group within the ITP. And we also co-founded a network to help fight modern slavery in the hotel industry in the UK with Shifa Foundation, another platform where we can get together with the industry to develop tangible solutions to collaborate and fight those risks together. Now, throughout all of this journey, as we continue to implement our strategy and drive collaboration at an industry level, there is one key thing that is really appealing internally is actually the pride that our team members take in getting trained and getting more awareness around certain risks that may exist and how we help them be empowered to identify the risks and mitigate them. This is a core part also of our strategy implementation. It's very much to drive that empowerment of team members. Each can realize that through their daily work, they can help change the world, whether in housekeeping, in procurement, in HR, in legal. Each of them has a role to play to help identify and mitigate risks. And this goes back to what I was saying at the very beginning, where this is reflecting back our core values. In fact, in the meantime, about a year ago, we reviewed and updated our mission at Hilton. And now in our mission, it is stated black and white that it is our mission to create a positive impact in our communities. From a human rights lens perspective, it very much means driving respect for human rights. So as a conclusion, I would just like to share 3 points to perhaps that can perhaps help individuals who are trying to drive the business and human rights agenda in their companies. The first one would be to link to the values of the company. Whatever the values of the company, there should be a way to link it to the essence of respect for human rights. The second point would be to build and tell positive stories so that the approach to human rights is not only a scare issue, but is actually an appealing agenda where colleagues and the whole company wants to be part of making a difference. So it's finding that right balance between the red flags and the positive stories. And finally, to drive the agenda in a tangible and effective manner, it's about using the language of traditional business drivers to embed human rights risks into the thinking and doing of companies. I will stop there and happy to take questions later.
Sure, no, thank you. Thank you, Caroline. I wonder, could we talk a little bit about pre-competitive collaboration? Something that is widely talked about, but often very hard in practice. What were the barriers for collaboration for Hilton with peer companies, and how did you get around them?
To be honest, we found through that forum of international tourism partnership a great basis for collaboration. There hasn't been much barrier because we all realize that this is a key item and agenda that we need to drive forward in our respective companies, that we all have to drive it relatively fast, given the moving regulatory environment, other pressures that I mentioned earlier, and that we see the benefits of sharing tools. The risks that we are facing across operations and supply chain are similar from one company to the other, and we cannot manage those risks by ourselves. Those are systemic issues. And however big our names may suggest that we are as companies, we really cannot single-handedly move the needle. We need to get together as an industry. And there is that broad understanding in our collaboration. And we are really putting together everything we can through the International Tourism Partnership to share knowledge, good practice, and develop tools that can have an impact.
Okay, thanks so much, Caroline. Maurizio, can I put that point to you? What about from your work at the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre and also developing the benchmarking? You know, how are you seeing companies and sectors collaborating around human rights risks more?
That's a very good question. There are definitely collaborations and but yeah, I think if you compare it with 5 or 10 years ago, they are collaborating more. We have seen the emergence of associations whose entire mandate is around human rights issues. So for example, there is the Global Network Initiative around for the ICT sector around issues of right to privacy, freedom of expression, and other rights that are affected by the ICT sector. You have the Global Business Initiative on Human Rights. You have the International Council of Mining and Metals for the extractive sector, whose main issues are around social and environmental issues. You have IPIECA for the oil sector. You have, obviously, BSR, and you have the International Organization of Employers also engaged in a lot of these discussions. I regularly meet them at relevant panels and events. I would say it's enough to look at the attendees of the last UN forums on business and human rights to see how that event has grown year after year. And every year I'm amazed at the amount of new initiatives and new organizations and associations that are disclosed there and that come to discuss around these issues in Geneva with everybody else. I remember I've been going to every UN Forum on Business and Human Rights since the beginning in 2011, and the first one probably had around 300 or 400 participants, and the last one had over 3,000 delegates. And that goes to show how this issue has grown in importance and how companies also realize that, yeah, by coming together, they have a much more powerful voice and have much more leverage to do. Obviously, in these examples that I mentioned, I didn't even mention the older initiative like the voluntary principles or the Equator principles, the EITI and all the rest. So increasingly, we have seen that by coming together, businesses feel there is more value to be done in acting on human rights issues. Having said all that, a lot of the most interesting initiatives or steps that we have seen in recent years have come from individual companies as well. I'll give you two examples. One is Adidas, who was the first ever company to issue a standalone policy on human rights defenders. And that was widely welcomed by the UN as well as the civil society because of the increased restrictions and attacks under which these human rights defenders find themselves operating in different countries. And Adidas, recognizing that increased danger, decided to create a policy on human rights defenders, but not only just create the policy, but also act on the policy. And we have seen some actions that they have taken in Cambodia and Vietnam and perhaps other countries that are exactly in line their human rights defenders policy. And we would encourage other companies to follow their lead. And the other example was in 2015, when a prominent journalist and human rights defender in Angola was facing charges of 9 years in prison after writing a book exposing abuses, human rights abuses in the diamond industry. There were a few diamond companies that decided to issue a public statement calling on the charges to be dropped. And one of the companies was Tiffany. And the charges, most of the charges were indeed dropped after, you know, pressures from the international community, but also from the diamond companies. And it was widely seen as a victory for human rights. And later that year, when I spoke with Rafael Marquez, the journalist, he did say that the statement that Tiffany had issued had made a very positive impact in most of his charges being dropped by the generals who were pursuing him. So it's important for me to mention that individual action is still helpful in some cases, and it can produce change in some cases. I wouldn't want companies to go away from here thinking that the only course of action is by collective action. But certainly, collective action is something that can be transformative in some cases and is very, very well worth considering.
Okay, thank you very much, Mauricio. Let me turn to some of our questions coming in. Thank you very much indeed for the questions that are coming in. They're coming in thick and fast. Going back to comments which both our panelists made on millennials and talent recruitment. Let's see this a little bit further. What statistical data or trends are there which clearly demonstrate the relationship between job seekers and human rights? Caroline, can you tell us what you've been tracking at Hilton?
Absolutely. If you look in general across CR, you see that about 78% of millennials are looking to work for a company that has strong CR and strong values. And so you would definitely integrate human rights in that for sure. But what is interesting as well is flipping the question. If you think about how many millennials and or anybody really would like to work for a company that is knowingly violating human rights. So this is also interesting to think in that context, and this is also why I was making the comments around the importance of seeing the team member empowerment around training to help them identify risks and support us in that global strategy to find ways to mitigate those risks as well. Because this is a place where not only do you, you don't just do your job has actually a meaning. And in this case, integrating human rights across every single department and function in a company means that you are bringing and embedding a purpose that we know is paramount for the newer generation, but frankly also a lot of people, team members of all age who might want to see a meaning in the work they are doing.
Just to push on that, I mean, do you think it's definitely just the millennial generation that are concerned with these aspects? It strikes me that a broader section of society is becoming more engaged in these things as well.
Yeah, I, without entering the debate around the definition of millennials, which I personally think is more of a mindset than an age range, I would think that really thinking about the meaning of a job and the position that we have in our society is certainly a key driver. It does vary in different places in the world, perhaps, but this is definitely a key driver in making a job meaningful and purposeful. And certainly the impact of your job, technically, potentially on human rights. There is nothing more important than that in understanding the impact you may have on the world.
Well, thanks. It's nice to know that I might indeed be a millennial by outlook, if nothing else. Thank you, Caroline. Mauricio, I wonder if I can turn to you. I've got another question I want to put to you, and it comes back to a little bit around the legislative change. A questioner particularly wants to know how companies are responding to the increased enforcement of the Tariff Act in the US, where shipments can be seized of goods that are suspected to have been produced with forced labor. How are you seeing companies responding to that?
Yeah, actually, that legislation is coming up more and more in our context. We saw, I can't remember right now the name of the company, but there was a company that was whose products were definitely confiscated by the U.S. Customs authorities after coming from Thailand and with strong suspicions of forced labor being involved in producing them. And the company wasn't a big company. It was a relatively small company, but it had to go into administration as a result of a few shipments that were confiscated under that law. So it has real impacts for companies. This is not a theoretical exercise. This is something that definitely can impact companies very critically. And therefore, they are taking notice and they are paying attention. Initially, unfortunately, some companies, the initial reaction of them is go by the gut instincts and by the legal advice, which says, you know, we need to do whatever is necessary to appear to be complying with the law. So they first try to make the necessary arrangements that in the face of the law, it looks as if they are complying. But you know, more serious companies are taking the issues more seriously and face to face, and you know, and directly hitting them in the face, and then looking at the actual supply chain and how they can use their leverage under pressure with their contractors and subcontractors in order to change the reality on the ground, which obviously is a more systematic way of changing things and will produce far better results when you know to comply with legislations such as this one. We have heard from the Trump administration that they were making noises that they wanted to repeal that legislation, which was enacted by the Obama administration. It hasn't happened, and it looks like the Trump administration won't have the enough support in Congress to make that happen. So for the time being, that is in place, and companies are advised to seriously look at the supply chains and, you know, try to use their influence to change the situation for the better.
Thank you very much indeed. Next question I'd like to discover or to talk about really is something around practicalities of finding out what it is that companies need to engage with particularly. And I'll come back to you, Caroline, on this. Our question wants to know about particularly around materiality and how to go about doing a materiality assessment for human rights in particular. Caroline, how did you at Hilton do materiality assessment for your human rights risks?
Sure. This is, and I would say, possibly the most important exercise to conduct internally to get started really on the approach. So I would really strongly recommend it. Where basically it's doing a better understanding of all of the business activities that a company may have in the market and in society in general. So it's not just looking at your core trade, but also at all of the ramifications of your enterprise, notably throughout your business relationships, upstream and downstream. Then you look at the different human rights, and they are codified, that exists, and you identify the ones that may impact. From there, you chose a number of criteria to better understand what the impact may look like in terms of severity, in terms of how long that impact would be, whether it is reversible or not, and so on. So yourself or some that you can find through other best practices. And once you've identified those criteria, this helps you prioritize and rank where you should focus first, most urgently, given those impacts. One key thing that is important to bear in mind throughout that exercise is to make sure that out of that exercise, some smart KPIs, right, are put together to know what we're trying to achieve so that we can make sure that we are delivering on certain projects, on certain priorities. It can be very daunting because virtually all companies may impact all human rights. But that's not a strategy. It's very important to prioritize and to stick to that agenda to make sure that we drive progress. It's hard because it means that you can't tackle all of the risks you may have identified at once, but that's kind of a business and human rights in real life and away from the textbook, and that's the only way that we can make a tangible change.
Just coming back to the KPIs, what's the balance between having some tangible quick wins just for to demonstrate to your colleagues that look at this, we are moving things forward and we've made some achievements. What's the balance between that and the sort of really tough, long-term, hard and tricky KPIs that the ones that you really need to engage with, but are they going to be the most difficult? How do you get that balance?
Both. You want to do both. Absolutely. And I think it's like any agenda that is relatively new to colleagues. You know, we had those discussions 20 years ago with the environment and then with the rise of corporate responsibility. You want to have some quick wins that makes your colleagues feel good and feel like there is some good story to tell. So that's back to one of the points I made that at the end of my comments earlier. Build and tell positive stories. It's important that there are some positive stories on this journey so that we feel that there is progress, because otherwise it can be a bit too daunting. And by building progress and positive stories, it's also a good opportunity to bring more colleagues into the fold who will be more willing and more who will be by then more aware of what we're actually talking about, because that's, even that very first question is not an easy one. And then understand the vision. By having good stories, they will be part of it. They will be co-creators and co-drivers of the vision. And then you can start integrate and open up to some of the more difficult topics that you want to tackle.
Thank you very much indeed. Mauricio, turning to you, question about the CHRB. It initially focuses on three sectors only. So I wondered, what other sectors do you think, what other sectors are going to be in the next wave for the CHRB? And why are you choosing them now? Mauricio.
Yeah, that is right now in development, actually. There is a consultation open right now for the next iteration of the benchmark, and the steering committee is going around different countries around the world talking with companies, with civil society, with governments, in order to gather as much feedback as possible to the first iteration, and then they're going to come back together and put their minds together and decide what's the best way forward. There are you know, two broad options. One is to stick with the same three sectors, the agricultural sector, the apparel sector, and the extractive sector, and repeat the exercise next year just to see what has been the movement among companies in the benchmark. And another option is to add more sectors and more companies to the benchmark. In reality, it's also a resources question, and you know, at the moment we are looking for more funding for the benchmark, and depending on the benchmark, we can be more or less ambitious. I think a preference of everybody involved in the benchmark would be to expand the benchmark to include more sectors and more companies. But you know, unfortunately, it's also a matter of constraints of resources. So we'll see. I would just say, watch this space. The work is going as we speak in terms of the consultation with stakeholders, but also in terms of fundraising, and those two things together will determine the future of the benchmark.
Can you give us examples of the sectors that you're looking at?
Yeah, the moment we are looking at, you mean to add?
Yes.
Yeah, I think I've heard that, you know, I'm not part of the committee that is looking at the expansion, but, you know, from what I heard is things like the ICT sector, is things like the potentially the construction sector and the tourism sector indeed.
Thank you. So, Caroline, the benchmark, would you welcome the hospitality sector being part of that? What impact would it have on Hilton?
I guess it's one. It's another tool and platform that goes back to the reference framework of the UN Guiding Principles. So, in that respect, I think it's not something that would be unexpected or unfair, indeed, in the sense that the CHRB very much follows the UN Guiding Principles. It would certainly be quite an undertaking, especially with regards to the time that it may take to collaborate with the CHRB on filling in the answers and providing information, which, as usual, with any type of reporting in any domain, it's always a challenging balance between reporting on the work versus doing the work. Like any other company, there is always a constraint in terms of pretty much always being the same team or the same individuals doing both work. But in terms, I guess, what would be interesting is to see how the CHRB is looking at learning from its first iteration. I think there were a number of very interesting lessons learned from that first iteration. See what type of feedback and updates they may want to integrate in the methodology, and then let's see where they go. But in general, it's a transparency tool.
Great. Well, thank you. Thanks for that. There's a lot of questions looking at the recruitment issue. So I'd like just to dial back a little bit and Caroline, put another question to you. Does Hilton use a positive human rights and business story as part of its recruitment process? Do you talk about purposely your you know, positive impact on human rights that you're trying to have?
I think in our recruitment language, we have a broader message around positive impact in our communities. Like I said earlier, this is one of the key tenets of our mission. And in that space, we tell our broader corporate responsibility story, which does include human rights. Now, in terms of the very details of the type of messages that would be delivered to the potential candidates, I'm not sure that human rights is necessarily a big part of it. And to be honest, I don't know whether that is a conscious decision or whether it's just based on the general knowledge across our colleagues in HR that is, you know, about our overall CR story, So I guess, yeah, I wouldn't have a very definite answer to that. I would love to see more human rights, I guess, in these presentations. But it's very much something, in any case, when I speak with prospective students who are interested in Hilton in general, I definitely do share not only our CR story, but also our human rights story. And it's interesting to see the interest it may generate from bright eyes in terms of knowing that, you know, those were real issues, all the way through to surprise and, I guess, delighted surprise that indeed we are taking this seriously and putting so much in place. So that's good to see, which again goes back to what we were saying earlier in terms of the interest and the real interest in having purpose, right, in the job that you are doing and joining a company that is aligned with your values and that really takes such serious matter at heart and with real strategic thinking and doing.
Thank you. Thank you, Caroline. That actually takes me very nicely on to the next question. I'd like to put this to Maurizio. And it's particularly, it's a kind of, almost like a little bit of a cry for help, really, from a representative of a small company. So what are the best things that can be done to help for small and for SMEs that don't have experts like Caroline in-house? How can we help them take action on human rights in their supply chains? Maurizio.
Yes, thank you. That is a good question. So there are many consultancies out there that are now increasingly specializing on human rights issues and have developed the expertise necessary to advise companies on what's the best way forward on human rights issues. And they are out there and easy to find through Google and through, you know, connections. And if they can, then I'm sure they can ask you, Ian, or they can ask us for recommendations. Now, I honestly don't know what exactly are the prices that these consultants charge. It may be that they are unaffordable for a small and medium company. I really don't know. It's worth asking. But if they are too expensive, one thing, at least to one place to start from, is the information that is freely available, that is out there, is on the website of the UN Working Group on Business and Human Rights, is on our own website, is on the website of Innovation Forum, I'm sure, and a few other organizations that specialize in this issue. SHIFT, for example, who are developing that reporting initiative on the UN Guiding Principles that Caroline mentioned, and others. So a place to start is to just dedicate a few hours to look for those materials, read them, and see what steps can be done to implement the most straightforward aspects of the issue, or to contact some experts. So there are a lot of experts actually out there that would be very happy to advise companies on specific issues on human rights for free, just because it's a topic that interests them greatly and that they care a lot about it. I'm thinking about academics that work on business and human rights who, you know, are very committed people, and are very knowledgeable, and I'm sure some of them at least would be happy to help companies with specific queries and specific issues. I'm also thinking about, you know, the team that used to work with John Ruggie when he was developing the UN Guiding Principle, when he was a special rapporteur. Some of those people are out there, and you know, I happen to know that they would be very happy to answer specific queries from companies about these issues. So, yeah, I think that's it.
Well, thank you, Richard. Yes, there certainly are plenty of materials available. Not least on Innovation Forum's website, is a gratuitous plug for me there. Caroline, a question for you from our audience, and it's really about thinking about the broader impacts of a business, particularly one that's consumer-facing. How much does Hilton see its role to try to change the your customers' wider practices in terms of human rights? So how much is there a sort of advocacy for generally everybody dealing with these matters differently? And is that something that is part of your strategy?
Yeah, thank you for that question, and that's a very interesting one. I guess, especially for the hospitality industry, which is it's a funny industry. It's very well known in terms of household names. However, its structure is quite odd, in the sense that our customers, in a way, would be of a couple of nature. So you have obviously the guests, right, who stay at our hotel. And in certain cases, in some of our hotels, we are sharing some information about risks, for example, of trafficking. So it's just in some hotels where we work in collaboration with the ownership group. You do also see that second type of clients, and I put that in quotation mark, in the sense of our owners, who are our business partners. So we do not own many of our hotels, very, very few, in fact. So we work with our business partners, who are our owners, on these issues as well. We do see them as our clients in a way, in the sense that they are buying into our brand, if you wish, right? They would become our franchisees. And so in that sense, there is definitely a discussion with them around making sure that we are all aligned on our values and on our projects. So that's also another aspect. This is all, you know, nascent, and we are building good practices in this area, but this is definitely something that we have identified.
Thanks very much. And Caroline, seeing with you, just moving that along a little bit, can you identify for your business and also for your sector, what has been the singularly most challenging human rights principle to incorporate into your operations? What's been the thing that's really been most difficult?
I'm not sure that I could necessarily pinpoint into one single area as being more or less difficult. I think across the board, the whole human rights agenda is challenging, like any other company will appreciate. This is an area where, you know, you have to find the best ways to integrate into the different governance. So I guess what I would say, rather than pinpointing at a specific area, I would just say that the key to success and the biggest challenge is to dive into the details. The details of the way you procure, the details of the way you hire, the details of business relationships of different sorts. And that does require literally going into the fine lines and understanding the smallest intricacies of how a business relationship is built and how we can embed the understanding of certain risks in order to prevent any harm from happening or understand how we can mitigate in different situations. So I guess that's what I would say. But now, whether it's the most challenging, yes, it is, but that's the job. That's exactly what it means to embed human rights in the different processes of due diligence across a company.
Thanks very much. Mauricio, can I turn that to you? Are you seeing now a trend of companies really now engaging on the detail? The devil is often in the detail in these things. Is that something you're seeing in your work, Mauricio?
I would say yes, that is something that we are seeing. You know, for example, many companies that used to be used to react to these things in a very defensive or reactive way. For example, when there were lawsuits against them over human rights issues, they were used to argue in court that they are not responsible for what their subsidiaries do or don't do abroad. That argument has had a fairly high degree of success in court. You know, we could go into the detail of the, you know, US and UK common law legislation versus the civic law legislation of continental Europe and other countries, and which legal strategies have worked better or not, but that is for another webinar. For now, it suffice to say that it has had some degree of success. However, that same argument does not shield companies from other type of reputation risks, such as protests or boycotts or campaigns or even regulatory action by other governmental bodies, other than the, you know, kind of legal, more formal legal prosecution structures. And therefore, companies that understand this, that, you know, it can still affect them, even if strictly legally speaking is not going to, they are not going to be liable for, they have realized that they must look into the details of these issues, which, you know, we acknowledge they are not simple issues. Some human rights issues are hugely complicated, hugely complex, and they take a while to assess and identify, but also to actually tackle in practice. But both the reputational risks that are avoided by doing that and also the reputational rewards that are potentially gained by doing that are immense. And therefore, more and more companies are deciding to look into the details of the matter and tackle them head on.
Okay, well, thanks very much. We are coming towards the end of our time, and I just would like our panel to sum up by thinking around our central question, and you know, what really will make companies act on business and human rights. So, Mauricio, coming to you first then, you know, just sum up, please, by telling me, you know, what are perhaps the two things that really make businesses act on business and human rights?
The main two things are, internal pressure and external factors. In the internal factors, I would include CEOs that are increasingly more active in these issues and are taking these issues much more seriously. There's a recent study by the Harvard Business School about CEO activism and what is driving that whole change. The pressure from employees, so this whole issue of millennials that we've been discussing, and the investors of the companies that are asking more and more questions and expecting much better results about this. So these are a whole set of internal factors. And then there are the external factors that are, you know, the broader stakeholders, the international community and society at large, that increasingly expects companies to respect human rights, to perform better in terms of human rights, because they identify that there is a crisis in the trust that society has in businesses, and the only way to bridge that gap is by having responsible companies and not just seemingly doing the responsible thing, but actually doing it. And in that regard, I would emphasize something that Caroline said, which is, telling a positive story is very, very important. In our work covering business and human rights issues, is still far much easier to come across negative stories than positive ones in terms of human rights. I know from experience that companies are shy about their positive human rights steps because they are fearful that they may come to hand words if they kind of stick their neck out in some of these issues. But actually, you know, telling that positive story is hugely important for others to know what is going on, for them to communicate. So I would finish by saying that.
Thank you, Mauricio. And I'm sorry, we had one or two just minor technical problems there, but I think we all managed to get your gist. So, Caroline, turning to you then, just to sum up, is it all about not being fearful to tell the positive story?
I guess I would like to just complement what Mauricio said, which he identified, of course, all of the different push and pull triggers for companies. I would like to just maybe have some reflection around the role of somebody who is trying to drive the agenda from within the company to drive the company to act on human rights indeed. What I would say is definitely indeed telling the good story, definitely linking back to the values, which I think are the fundamental. And then it's using all of those different drivers that Mauricio mentioned to help appeal to different colleagues, different teams, because the same argument is not gonna work for everyone. And we need, and a company is a composite of individuals and departments that think differently. So I would say using all of these different levers to build a story and paint a picture that will appeal to the colleague that you are trying to bring on board. And all of that also to join the dots, because different drivers will impact different teams. And I think it's the role for whomever is trying to drive the business and human rights agenda to show that there is a cohesive story there, that it's not just one commercial driver here or one legal requirement there. There is actually a whole movement around business and human rights, and that's what needs to be painted and tied back to the company's values.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much indeed, Caroline. I'm going to bring things to a close there as we're running out of time. I'd like to thank our panel very much for their time and insight today. Once again, if you'd like to continue the debate on the critical risks for business around human rights, then do join us in London in November. We'll send you a recording of this webinar so you can listen to it again at your leisure and share with your colleagues, of course. And we also always welcome feedback, so please don't hesitate to contact any of us at Innovation Forum with any follow-up questions or comments. For now, I hope you found the past hour interesting, and thank you very much for listening.